Tonight we're talking about, I'm supposed to say, I'm Gary Pence, and this is Ghost or Monster Images of the Church. We're talking about images tonight, and I've been wearing an image around today in order to titillate the interest of people and see whether it would pull out a crowd tonight to find out what the question was that goes with the answer on the front of me. It occurred to me earlier today that there are an infinite number of questions to which 42 would be the answer. If you just stick at the numerical level, but it's interesting how many people figured out what the question ought to be. They thought it meant, what is your age? And in fact, they are right, I am 42, but that's not the question to which this is the answer. And then Paul Collinson String over here said that was the number of my seventh grade football jersey. So that's one of the questions to which this is the answer. And then I just heard here from Orv Jacobson that one of your kids' teachers,
right,
whenever the kids get unruly in class, says, turn to page 42. So that's another one of the infinite number of questions to which this could be the answer. In fact, this was a shirt given to me as a gag from a group at which one of the members kept referring to a book called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxies. And in that book, which was serialized on National Public Radio, apparently a computer gets asked what the meaning of all truth, all wisdom, what is it all about? Is that sort of it? Those of you that shook your heads, you'd heard of it? The meaning of the universe or something like that. And the computer says, I can handle that, but it's going to be tough. And they keep checking back with it for hundreds and thousands and millions of years, and the computer's working away, you know, really hard. And finally, it even gets help from a second computer along the way. And after waiting for all these eons, finally the computer says, I have the answer. It's 42. And the people say, you mean we've waited all these eons, all this time, and we've gotten you a second computer to help out, and that's the answer you give us? What does it mean? And the computer says, well, that'll be tough, but I think I can work on it. Well, tonight we are talking about images as important conveyors and shapers of meaning. And some of you who have been at Bill Rice's presentations on faith, mission, and culture heard him talk about how important it is for us to be living in a culture which shapes the meanings that we give to the world around us. And the way I described it last night was to say that the way we act, wait a minute, is that low enough for you to see? This canopy is a real interesting addition. The way we act in the world is dependent on the meanings that we find in the world. And those meanings that we find are based upon what we notice in the world. And what we notice are those pieces of the world that we see and attend to. That is, I look around, and what do I see? I could see so many things that I would just be paralyzed, because I couldn't make any sense out of it all. So what I do is I attend to certain pieces of what I see out there. I notice only part of it. I don't notice what all of you are wearing, who has hair and who doesn't, perhaps not, you know, who's male and who's female, but I notice a lot of faces, a lot of heads, and not much else. And because my sight isn't that great, I really don't see much else. So I notice some of it, and then I derive meaning from that, or give meaning to it. By an act of my imagination, I create an image of what I see, and on the basis of that image, I act. For example, the meaning that I give to this event is that you're a friendly group, and that you mean me well, that you are not a hostile group, and so I don't have to be on my guard, I don't have to protect myself, I can be myself with you. If I perceived you differently, or if I endowed what I saw with a different meaning, then I would act differently than I do tonight. Of course, I could be wrong. Nonetheless, that explains why I'm acting the way I am. So when we as human beings act, we do not or respond to the world around us, we do not do so the way animals do, by a direct response to stimuli from the world around us, interposed between the stimulus and the response is the action of our imagination, creating an image of the stimulus or stimuli that produces the response. Now that indicates why images are so important. They really construct our world for us and decide how we're going to act and how we're going to deal with the world. Bill Rice was showing how you take a world and some people look at it and they say, gee, this is a very dangerous world. This is a fearful place to live. And so we need to build bombs and we need to build bomb shelters. And that's my world. It's a dangerous and fearful place that we need to constantly be on guard against and protect ourselves from. Somebody else looks at the world and says, this is a hopeful place, filled with a lot of well-meaning people, and if we can only latch onto that side of them, we can build a world in which there don't need to be fences, walls, and bombs. Same world, different attention to it and different meanings applied to it. Now, another way in which images are important is that not only the world out there do we attend to and make images of, but we look at ourselves. We look at ourselves and we create a self-image and we act upon that self-image. Somehow we define ourselves by the image that we have of ourselves and then we act accordingly. And to illustrate that, I want to pass out to you a little sheet that will contain some stuff that's familiar to you. I would guess you all know how Snoopy in the Peanuts cartoons, take one for maybe every other person so there's enough to go around. And I'll try to get some up there. Did they make it? No. You can be looking at this while I'm... Great. Here, let me give you a couple more. Did they make it all around the room? Maybe there's only enough for every three people. What's coming around are a series of cartoons that show Snoopy imagining himself, creating for himself the image of the World War I flying ace. He's sort of a canine Walter Mitty. And it shows him acting out of that self-image which he's created, out of a role, just as a dramatist would create a role and perform it. And notice he creates a script consistent with the self-image. The World War I flying ace
cares little for fame or glory. His only wish is to do his duty, serve with honor, and perhaps be called stout fellow.
Fat, says Lucy. Stout!
That's one of the scenes. Now, these appeared in successive days on the same week in a newspaper I was taking. You notice you go down a little farther. Good fortune smiles on the World War I flying ace. Aha, the Red Baron's secretary has the secret papers. Hey, what are you doing? That's my term paper! Not fooled by the girl's simple cries, the flying ace darts swiftly away, and so forth. And then he swallows the paper in the next scene. Notice all of the thoughts that are going on in his head are a scene that he's concocted and plays out, causing a lot of consternation to those around him.
Well, what Snoopy does is what children do when they play and what we do when we play. But it's also what we all do as we live. How do we think of ourselves? Who do we think we are? What is the image that we want to convey to others and that we imagine we have ourselves? Images are important shapers of meaning, or are the carriers of the meanings that we give to the world around us, and they are the determiners of how we act. So it is with groups. The self-image of a group will determine how a group acts, how a church defines itself through the image that it has of itself will determine how that church is going to act. Who are we as a church? What does that imply about the scripts that we want to be saying to one another? What kind of actions are we going to be playing? What kind of a stage do we think we're on? And to illustrate that, I have some little sheets to hand out, which I'd like you to look at and then maybe get together with one or two people near you. And let's see if I can put these around. I don't have quite enough of these. This is a list of boats, all different kinds of boats. And what I'd like you to do is to look down that list of boats and imagine which of those boats do you think is the image that you have of the church today? As you think about the church today, which of those boats is the church as you see it? Why don't you discuss that for just a little bit with some couple people near you and talk about why? With an exercise like this, I'd like to give you about 10 minutes, but we don't have the time for that tonight. Let me find out what some of you came up with and why. Somebody like to volunteer? Yes, Charles.
Well, you're talking about petroleum tanker parking because it's huge and slow moving.
Uh-huh.
I think the image will depend on the culture in which the church lives. I can see it as a submarine in the cultures where the church is persecuted, the underground church.
That's a good point that you make, because when we say the way the church is, we probably think of the church in this country as our first reference point, and we forget there's a lot more to the church than what's in this country.
And tugboat, why?
Pushing and pulling all the time. Like a barge too, because it needs to be pushed.
Those are proletarian images. Is that what you intended? For both tugboat and barge. Anyone else? Yes.
Aircraft carrier.
Why?
Well, if you've been on aircraft carrier, there's a lot of individual groups on there, and that's like the ALC and
Missouri Synod, Wisconsin, and you name it. They're all on the same ship, but they're separate.
Uh-huh. And just like on the ship, they work together very collaboratively. Okay. Yes.
Ocean liner.
Okay.
Because it's large, it gathers its passengers from every walk of life, and it has a definite destination.
Uh-huh. Called a love boat. Okay. Yes.
I think it's pronounced the trireme because I don't have the foggiest idea what it is.
So that's your choice. The one that's a mystery. Right. Trireme is a classic Greek or Roman three-oared, either a warship or a cargo ship. You know, like in the movies where the slaves are pulling on the oars. Okay. There's an interesting thing about images. Every one of these, although however different they are plausible images. They are angles through which one could credibly understand the church. They're not just right or wrong. They bear a variety of meanings, and people can say, oh yeah, I can see that. It is like a trireme, or it is like an ocean liner in certain ways. It is like a tugboat. Or a submarine. You know, it's got, depending on where you are and what's interesting to you and what you notice about the church, you can make practically any of these fit. And that's one of the beauties of images, that they are not right or wrong. They are, instead of constricting or placing borders and parameters around meaning, they tend to open up meaning, just as story does. Just as plays. In fact, art in general tends to open up meaning rather than to constrict it by close definition, placing borders around meaning. Sometimes a church acts out of images of which it's unaware, and this is where the ghost and monster stuff came from that I put in the title. In order to con you here this evening. And that refers to an article that was in the June 2nd issue of the Christian Century just a week or two ago, called Ghostly and Monstrous Churches by a professor at Candler School of Theology in Emory University in Atlanta. And he is using images according to one particular use, namely as a way of praising or criticizing. Here it's mainly critical. He's saying that churches since the 60s have been either operating out of an image of a ghost, or in the 70s out of the image of a monster. And what he meant by that was that a ghost is a very different thing from a monster. A ghost is a sort of a spirit that can escape from a body and go floating off other places and haunt something else. And he said, back in the 60s, there appeared a whole lot of literature on church renewal, which he thinks saw the church as a ghost. That is, it was the kind of stuff that was in Gibson Winter's The Suburban Captivity of the Churches. And in the same year, Peter Berger's The Noise of Solemn Assemblies. It was in the WCC, World Council of Churches documents that Colin Williams wrote, Where in the World and what in the World. And in all of those studies, the point was made that the church in its present body is defunct. The church as congregation is defunct, and the church ought to leave that body and go out and haunt the world. It ought to go out there into the world and forget about this now defunct body of the local congregation. That was typical stuff that was being written back in the 60s. And he said this is an image of the church as a kind of a disembodied spirit which can go around and inhabit and haunt the houses of the city in the spiritist sense of haunting, to link and help people in crisis. Almost like the Sahala power among the Batak people, that what the church is does not need to reside in a body, but needs to go out and empower other bodies out there in the world. And then he said that in the 70s, there came a shift in images, and you began to see a new kind of literature about church renewal, which is associated with the church growth movement. And in this new literature, the congregation, while understood to be kind of sick and weak and ailing, the people writing this literature said, but we can fix it. We can bring it back to health. We can get it moving again. And the author here says that's like the image of a monster. A monster is a body which is discovered or created, and the scientist, through use of certain technologies, brings it to life, like Frankenstein, brings to life this inert body. And if you only know how to do it, if you've got the right technology, you can get it to work. And typically these monsters are bigger than life, 8 feet tall, huge, scary, powerful, and if they're on your side, great things can happen. What's that TV show with the Incredible Hulk? Kind of a monster created by technology. And if he's on your side, things are good. But monsters are also frightening because they can end up causing a lot of trouble, running amok and all that sort of thing. And anyway, church growth he sees as the new kind of technologically based literature that says, if you learn our schemes, our techniques, our technologies, we'll get you a big church. It will be monstrous. No need to be content with congregations of 400. Get 3,000 like ours. That will be a monster of a church. So anyway, this author closes in the final paragraph only. He points out that sometimes the church is following images which are of questionable validity within the Christian community, and the churches really need to examine the images that in fact they're following, whatever their official images might be. Now, what's next? Okay, so this author illustrates the first use of images, which is that they provide a way of praising or blaming something, and doing it in an evocative way. You feel a kind of disgust before you even read the paper when you find the author talking about ghosts and monsters. So praise and blame is one important use of images. For example, referring to a congregation as a country club. That's nothing but a country club. Or praising it, in a sense, by saying, it's a family. We are a family. How many church bulletins have some little squib in it every Sunday? We are God's people gathered here, the family of God's people. You're welcome to be a part, and all that kind of stuff. So it's a way of praising or blaming. A second use of images is to try to describe something which is too mysterious or too inherently beyond definition, beyond human grasp. So let's say, describe the indescribable. Is that B-A-B-L-E, indescribable? I? Is it an I or an A? Okay, I don't know. Describe the indescribable, like Darius wanting to say, it's a trireme. I don't know what it is. Okay, and so when it's difficult and mysterious to put into words, we grasp for images that might evoke the meaning. Since we can't really define it specifically and clearly. And so you get these images of chosen people. The church is a vineyard. Sheep and shepherd. And many of those images have grown up in the church over many centuries. Many centuries. People begin to use this kind of talk. It's built into the fabric of their social and community life. And so one of the things you do with images like that is go back and look how they've been used over the centuries and see if you can recover the different meanings that those images had for the Christian community and at different stages in its development. And that way you can help to recover the many different meanings that sometimes were conveyed to people by the same image. Like people of God. We are the people of God. It's hard for us to grasp the various meanings of that because people in our country has very individualistic meanings to it. It's a collection of individuals. If we were to use the German word Volk or the Greek word Laos or Laos, you'd get more of a sense of the people. It's the nation. It's the collective group. The people of God is the historic nation of Israel, now the new Israel. So we need to go back and see how words were used in the history of the Christian community in order to recover all the dimensions of meaning that are open to us there. Now, the third use of images is the one that I'm particularly interested in tonight because I'm interested in questions of church renewal. And the third use of images is as tools to shape identity. If we act out of images that we have of ourselves, then one way to change the actions of people is to change their self-image. If someone thinks they're one thing and they act out of it in a way that is not happy, then you say, well, now how can I get that person to see herself or himself in a different way? How can I shift the image? Because if the image changes, then the direction will change, the way that that person becomes or that group acts will change. Let's say that it's images then can be a center for cohesion within a group. A rallying point for esprit de corps. Think of Holden Village. Holden Village itself is an image.
You just say Holden Village. You wear it on your t-shirt. That's an image. And it means a whole layer of things to people who have experienced it. And you meet somebody from Holden Village sometime and they're wearing their t-shirt off in Florida. And you say, you've been to Holden Village? When were you there? I was there, and blah, 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 you know, and you start bringing up all the old stuff that appears in those songs that we sing at mealtimes. So take images that could change a church. Like, what if the church saw itself as a rock of stability? Remember some of the images last night? We are a rock of stability in a sea of change. And contrast that with, we are the rebels around here. We are the rebels. We're the ones that shock people in this area. Guess what we did last week? Or how about, we are the preservers of the received values, the values that came out of our past. You can trust us. We're going to keep the values of our forebears, of our parents, of our grandparents alive for our future generations. That could be an image of a congregation. Or, we are inventors. We are the creative ones. We are the ones who see new possibilities. How about the church as obedient nitwit versus genius? We are the ones that grasp possibilities and act on them. Well, images, some have said, are a key to change. And the renewal of images is seen to be a way of renewing the culture. So let's say that history is moving along like this. You could call this the force of history, moving relentlessly from year to year, decade to decade, and it's going to end up here. And let's say you can look at history and you say to yourself, I don't like the way it's going. That's not the direction I'd like it to go. Some of us feel that way about the whole nuclear peace war issue today. And that's a big concern here at Holden. Well, what are you going to do about it? Those that are interested in images and those that are interested in the arts say, well, look what we're going to try. We are going to seed history with some different images. We're going to seed history with an image that would take us here. Let's call it the biblical image of the day when the lion lies down with the lamb and the baby plays around the snake's hole. And let's say you flesh that out in drama and art and whatever. And so you, in effect, you seed historical movement with images that are incongruent with where it's going. And the hope is that if those images get heard or experienced, it's going to change the trajectory of history so that history, instead of going here, will go somewhere off here. Now, maybe not here, but we'll put a prime on it, somewhere in that direction. And maybe we should be happy even if it goes here. Huh? If this is Armageddon or the destruction of the world, then we're happy if we get it here. So images can be used to seed a community in a way to change the force of the direction that it's now taking. Images were very important, in fact, were central to the biblical material. And before I hand this material I have out to you, let me read a couple passages just to remind you of how potent images are in the New Testament. First
out of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5. You, the church, and this we'll take it that way, are the salt of the earth. If salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and stepped on by people. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a bushel basket. They put it on a light stand, and it gives light to the whole house. Let your light so shine out before people that they can see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. Now try this from 1 Peter. 1 Peter. I was astonished when I picked this up this afternoon. Notice the barrage of images. This is bathed with images. Like newborn babes, long for the pure spiritual milk, that by it you may grow up to salvation. For you have tasted the kindness of the Lord. Come to him, to that living stone, rejected by people, but in God's sight chosen and precious. And like living stones, be yourselves built into a spiritual house, to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices, acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, that you may declare the wonderful deeds of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were no people, but now you are God's people. That's taking off from Hosea. Isn't that right? Where it says you are now no people and now you are my people. You were once no people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I beseech you as aliens and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, etc., etc. Look at that parade of images given out in luxurious abundance. That's the new math of the use of images. Those of you that were here last night, the economy of grace. Here, would you like to take these? And I've got for you a lineup of, again, please take one for about every second or third person. There's a wonderful book that I commend to you, written quite a few years ago, and yet still useful, and it's Paul Meinier, Images of the Church in the New Testament, published by Westminster Press. And it was out of print for a while, but it's back in print. Paul Meinier did his study of images as part of a World Council of Churches project seeking unity among the churches. And Meinier said to himself, you know, the way the churches define themselves, it makes it almost sure that they'll never be unified, because the way they define themselves, they do it in a way that separates them from other churches. They define themselves by contrast with other denominations. And he said, why don't we look at images and see whether we don't all find ourselves in the same images? And look at what he found. 96 images in the New Testament for the church. And there he groups them under five different headings. A whole lot of little images, he calls them miscellaneous minor images. And some of those include some of those minority images of the church. Salt, light, and leaven. Those are images that are designed to convey the meaning of a church which is tiny. You don't want the whole room to be light. You want lights to be small, but their effects to be large. Same with salt. You don't want a meal made of salt with burger on the side. You want the burger enhanced by a little salt. And the same with leaven. You don't want to eat the leaven mixed with a little bread. You want the bread to rise because there's a little bit of leaven in it. That's an example of some of the little images that don't cohere around any particular center. But then there are four others that he finds to follow particular themes. People of God, those are historic images. They relate back to the people of God as Israel. I will take you for my people and I will be your God, God says in Exodus 6:6. This isn't people in general, but a nation that is God's possession. Doesn't belong to itself. It's set apart for God, by God. It belongs to God. That's why it's called a holy people, because it's a people set apart by God for God's purposes. That's the definition of holy. That's what it is to be consecrated. We consecrate the elements at communion. We set them aside for God's purposes. So the image of the people of God, the laos of God, the folk, is that it relates Christians today to a historic community whose origin goes all the way back to God's original covenant promises to Israel, and whose pilgrimage through history has been sustained by God's call. The next image, the new creation, is an altogether different idea. And the new creation, such as you find in 2 Corinthians, I read it last night, if anyone is in Christ, there's a new world, there's a new creation, the old has passed away, the new has come. Or how about James 1:18? Of his own will, the Father of lights brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Or Colossians 3:10, you have put off the old nature with its practices and have put on a new nature. That kind of talk. Here we see the church as a kind of a foretaste, a first fruits, a down payment on the fullness of future freedom. A kind of a down payment or a glimpse of what's in store for the world. And this image is not a historic image, it is a cosmic revolutionary image. Set the life of the Christian society within the context of God's eternal glory and life, and therefore within the context of the whole of the world's redemption. It's a big image of the church that looks forward to the end time when all things will be like what in the church today we see in small form, you know, as a little piece of the future action. And then let's skip ahead to the body of Christ. That's a commonly used image. It's a special one too, because it is not a cosmic image so much or a historic image. It's an image that focuses in on the internal life of the congregation or of the church as a fellowship, as a koinonia, as a communio. We are sitting in koinonia tonight in the building and experiencing koinonia. It's what is the communion of saints, the communio sanctorum. It's what Letty Russell, in that book Growth in Partnership last night, that I quoted to you, translates as partnership. If you don't want to say brotherhood,
because it's a sexist word. How about substituting partnership? That would be her proposal. We are baptized into one body. We are one bread, one body, a lot of Corinthians language. And here the church is understood as a fellowship in and with Christ. If you are in Christ, you are a new creature. You are part of the fellowship, the shared future with Christ, entered into through baptism and sustained through the Lord's Supper. So it's not a historic or a cosmic image, it's a social image. A social image. It expresses our interdependence, our connectedness with one another. It's a kind of mutuality, both in the gifts we've received and in the vocation to which we're called. So, Meinier has lifted up a number of biblical images that, if looked at and if the various meanings in them can be recovered, could become potent for the renewal of the church in the future. Then at the middle bottom of the page, I've shown you some images that Robert McCaffey Brown lays out in his book Frontiers of the Church Today. These are contemporary images of the church, which he commends for their power that they might have in moving us to new self-image. For example, the servant church. We are a servant. The movement, back in the 60s and 70s, when people, in fact, used to use that kind of language, didn't they? They're part of the movement. And it was a kind of subversive movement, a conspiracy. We could have put, instead of crew last night, as a futurist image of the church, we could have used the image conspiracy. Try that one on, because conspiracy means breathe together. Con means with, and spiro means to breathe. And a conspiracy is a group of people who breathe one another's breath and then go out and see if they can infect the world with their virus. They're a kind of typhoid Mary for the Lord. Or how about a cantus firmus? You know, those of you who are musical, that in contrapuntal music, in music like that in the Baroque period and also in modern jazz, frequently there's the hymn tune, which is the cantus firmus, and over it is the ornamentation or the filigree, the embroidery that plays around this long tune. Well, how about looking at the world as full of ornamentation, and somehow the church is that one that knows what the song is, to which all of the rest is ornamentation. You want to know what song we're singing in the world? Ask a Christian, and we'll tell you. And we're going to sing that song so everybody can hear it. We're coming to the end, and we don't have time to pursue further the ways that images might get used, but I wanted to lay out for you some of the range of images that have been imagined in the church through the centuries. And what would it be like if in our day there was a rebirth of imagination in the church? I heard Krister Stendahl, former dean of Harvard Divinity School, speak at our seminary a couple of years ago, and he said if there's anything the church needs in our day, it's a renewal, a rebirth of the imagination. If there's anything the world needs, it's a rebirth of the imagination. And if that rebirth occurs, then all of us would be like my two daughters, who can go out in the backyard. We have a really scuzzy backyard since we never have time or the effort and haven't thought we had the money to fix it up. So it's a real crummy place with weeds and sticks and stones, and the girls go out there and they dig holes and they make themselves little villages. And they dig little holes in and put sofas and stuff, and you find them take their little weebles and dollies out there, and they'll say, come out and see our village. And they've got a whole new society growing in our backyard out of their imagination. Can we do that with the weeds and the scraps that we find in the world around us and weave that into a foretaste of the new creation? Tomorrow morning, the theme is in, with, or under models of the church. What is the church for? And I hope to draw some more on some of this background, but also go on to another angle on it, which I'm getting out of a book by Avery Dulles called Models of the Church. And he suggests five different models for understanding the church, and we're going to move from that to talk about how do we get at what the church is really for anyway. So thanks for coming. Good to see you again.